Hey everybody, welcome to our fourth episode of Ankle Surgery Update. For us in Germany, COVID restrictions are being eased and the patient load is increasing again. It will be exciting to see which of the tools, such as video outpatient clinics and meetings, will stay in place. But for today, we're extremely excited that we will have our first interview podcast. In the future, we will try to find a balance between interviews with experts in the field and discussion of novel literature.
Today, we are very happy to have a guest. It's Ben Boschel from the UK. He's a podiatrist and is hosting his own podcast. We are very happy to have you, Ben. Maybe you introduce yourself quickly.
Yeah, sure. Thank you for that. So yeah, my name is Ben Boschel. I'm a podiatrist based in the UK. And I am the head of service at Hatt Health and Movement Clinic, which is in the southwest of the UK. I'm also author of the Plantar Fasciitis Bible, and I host a podcast called the Heel Pain Expert Podcast.
Also from my side, great to have you here on our podcast. I think for the two of us, it's actually the first interview style podcast that we do. So that is exciting. And we chose the topic of insertional tendinopathy of the Achilles tendon. So do you have any specific diagnostic approach if you see patients in your outpatient clinic?
Yeah, I think insertional tendinopathy is can be quite tricky from a specific diagnostic point of view. It's, in my experience, less common than mid-portion tendinopathy. And when I do encounter insertional Achilles tendinopathies, there are sometimes some other features going on, such as an apparent bump, which may be a bony exostosis, or may just be bursitis. So I do find a clinical examination alone can be quite tricky to make sure you're actually on the right tracks. And I do value diagnostic imaging to try and get a bit more accuracy on diagnosis.
What tools do you use for imaging?
So at the moment, I don't have immediate access to ultrasound in the clinic, which would be a godsend because that would really help with making a clinical diagnosis there and then with my patient in the room. So I do sometimes opt for a diagnostic ultrasound or I go for MRI. I don't tend to refer for x-rays for this condition. I think an x-ray may show that there is a bony exostosis, but that's not necessarily going to tell me why the patient is symptomatic. It's going to give me limited value on what's going on at the Achilles tendon in terms of the tendon fibers, and it's not really going to show me much with regards to bursitis either. So I'll tend to lean towards either MRI or ultrasound.
So you already mentioned that you look at the tendon, at the quality of the tendon on the MRI, at the possible bursitis. What else do you look at? What else and what impact does it have on your treatment approach?
Yeah, so when I refer a patient for an MRI, it's done at a local hospital, and there's a good team of musculoskeletal specialist radiologists, and they are far more expert than I am at interpreting MRI results. So I do rely on my colleagues to tell me what they think they can see going on, and then once they've written their report, I'll then focus on what those findings mean and then interpret that to the patient. I think the most frequent things I tend to see with when dealing with insertional pathologies is insertional tendinopathy, you know, of the tendon itself. And commonly there is signs of retrocalcaneal bursitis. So those are probably the two key things I'm looking for. I am interested if there is a superficial calcaneal bursitis, which is obviously quite a different condition and will have different causative factors related to it. And I'm interested in the mid portion of the tendon is actually healthy as well.
So what different treatment approaches do you take? For example, if you see a bursitis versus tendinopathy, do you make any difference regarding the treatment?
That's a good question. I find that if somebody has retrocalcaneal bursitis and it shows up positively with an ultrasound or an MRI, I do find they're more tricky to treat conservatively. And what I think does work well is an ultrasound guided corticosteroid injection specific into the retrocalcaneal bursa. I find that they're very irritable and don't settle down very easily. If the MRI or an ultrasound didn't identify bursitis, but just insertional tendinopathy, then I will be leaning more towards shockwave therapy as a treatment option. And shockwave therapy has been demonstrated to be effective for tendinopathy, but not for bursitis. If anything, it probably just that makes the bursitis more angry, in my opinion, because you're hammering it away on sac of fluid, which is already compressed and irritated. So I don't see how shockwave therapy is going to help with that. So I think the intricacies of what's going on pathologically do influence the a non-surgical treatment plan.
That's really interesting. If you talk about regular tendinopathy, do you also look at the musculoskeletal anemias, whether they have a tightness there or not? Does that play any role?
I'm not certain how relevant it is. And I think that's based on what I've read and what I've learned listening to other colleagues, you know, internationally who have PhDs on, you know, on the subject of Achilles tendinopathy. And there doesn't seem to be a consensus from my understanding that gastroc or Achilles tension is related to tendinopathies. And a lot of experts I know suggest not to stretch because that doesn't seem to be beneficial. So I'm not sure how important it is. I think incidentally, I see lots of it. So I think most of my patients who have insertional tendinopathy often do have gastrocnemius equinus, and I'll do the common clinical Silverschgold test to assess for that. But what I'm not certain on is whether that is incidental as opposed to causative.
So that's very interesting. Again, you don't prescribe stretching therapy?
With Achilles tendinopathy, I prefer to lean towards loading exercises. So doing more strengthening loading exercises for the tendon and having an emphasis on eccentric loading, as that seems to have, although limited quality evidence, it does have the best evidence of which exists at the moment. With regards to stretching, I do give my patients stretching exercises to do because although I'm not convinced there is a causative link, I'm not also confident that it's not relevant. So as long as it doesn't aggravate the patient's symptoms, I'm happy for them to be stretching. But I do sometimes find that with insertional Achilles tendinopathy particularly, doing stretching exercises irritates it. And that could be perhaps because that tendon is going to apply a bit more compressive stress to the retrocalcaneal bursa when sustaining a maintained dorsiflex position. But that's just what's going on in my head. I can't prove that.
That really is interesting. I think in Germany, we do interpret the literature a little different. For us, more pronounced in mid-portion, but also for insertional tendinopathia, we do have the feeling that if they do have a gastroc tightness and they do stretching exercise, around about 70% gonna experience a severe decrease in their symptoms over time. It's not gonna resolve it in a week or two, but we usually tell our patients to do it for 8 weeks straight and actually do it twice a day for 10 minutes. I think there's a protocol from the Dutch published that recommends that, and they even recommend 30 minutes if I'm not mistaken. And we actually do have pretty good experience with that, right, Hans?
Actually, we do the eccentric stretching not only if we observe gastrocnemius tightness, but even if we don't observe that and they just have an insertional pain. So actually, we prescribe this in every condition of insertional pain. Even in bursitis, we do that. And this is our first line treatment. And if that doesn't work, then we will progress.
It definitely is. But I think Ben is totally right. The vast majority, or at least a big majority, of the patients with insertional tendinopathy are going to have a positive Silverschgold test.
That's right. That's right.
That's and a actually, good coincidence.
It is. And I think this coincidence has not been studied enough yet. I'm not aware of a lot of studies really demonstrating this link, but I'm convinced there is a link, but it has not been focused on, I believe.
That's very interesting. So I feel that way about plantar fasciitis. So when I'm treating that, I am very, very, very pro-stretching. So that is the most important aspect of my treatment. And I think there is good evidence to prove a causative link between gastroc equinus and plantar fasciitis. And I think here in the UK, a lot of the physiotherapy and podiatry profession were very pro-stretching exercises for insertional Achilles tendinopathy also. It's still popular for plantar fasciitis, and the research is there to support that. But I think for insertional tendinopathy, in the UK at least, it seems to have fallen out of favour. And I suppose I've been influenced by, you know, what other experts are saying and other people's opinions. So I'm not as convinced there is a cause there. But I also agree that I don't think it's been studied robustly enough to actually know.
To come back to, you said you're going to, if they have retrocalcaneal bursitis, you're going to do a glucocorticoid injection. Do you just do that once? Or if the patient does experience severe decrease in pain for, let's say, a half a year, would you repeat that?
That's a good question. I rarely see people that don't respond well to it. If they don't respond well to it, I personally prefer to refer them on to a podiatric surgeon or an orthopedic surgeon to get their input on whether they think it's time for surgery or whether they would be more willing to try a second corticosteroid injection. So my approach is I'll refer a patient to receive one. I used to do it, but I don't have an ultrasound machine in the clinic anymore, so I can't currently do them myself. But I do refer them on to a radiologist that can do it. And I do find it works really, really well. When the pain recurs, that's when I'm referring on for a second opinion, really. It's just to make sure I'm not missing anything. And I think it's just always good to get somebody else's opinion if somebody's not responding to a treatment plan.
That actually is really interesting how you proceed, because for us, we do also do the glucocorticoid injection. Actually, we do it. We don't care whether it's a really prominent one or whether it's rather minor. We would still give it a shot. And at least from my experience, I'm not sure whether you agree, Hans, or not. As you said, you're often surprised on how good patients react to it, more or less independent of the severity of the bursitis you see.
But I think an important aspect is the clinical examination. If you see the patient and the patient has pain on palpation on the lateral or medial aspect, so in the region of the bursitis, rather than at the dorsal aspect, an aspect of the tendon itself, then this is a good hint that he will respond. And most of these patients do have a positive bursitis in MRI, although you might also see intratendineous lesions, but they do have a bursitis. And if their clinical examination is positive in terms of a bursitis, plus we see a bursitis in the MRI, then we offer this. But I think the clinical examination does give a strong hint where is the pain located. Because in the MRI, we regularly see various lesions. And the question then is, which of the lesions causes pain? Is it all of the lesions or is it only part of the lesions? I think the clinical examination gives us a very good hint. And the next step is the infiltration. If the infiltration is positive, but the pain comes back, then we do offer minimal invasive surgery for removal of the bursitis and bony burr.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. I think obviously you've got to be very careful with pairing up the MRI features with the clinical examination and not fall for a red herring, as what we call it in the UK, which means focusing on an incidental finding, which is of very little relevance to the patient. So yeah, completely agree. You've got to make sure that those two match up well.
This is very true for the bony burr as well. I mean, we see a lot of those Haglund exostoses, how they are regularly called, on X-rays taken due to an ankle sprain or whatever. So this is not necessarily a pathological situation.
Yeah.
I think it's the same with degeneration of the Achilles tendon. If you look at the figures we have for Achilles tendon ruptures, we're obviously going to see them with male patients at around the age of 40. If you look at the MRI, most often they do have degenerative changes in their tendon. So it is more or less acute and chronic what they experience. So some sort of degeneration in the tendon is as a Haglund exostosis, maybe physiological at a certain age, at least.
Yeah.
So you said you're not doing the injection yourself. Back in the days when you did you also do peer-to-peer or anything else that you would offer the patient?
No. So when I used to have access to diagnostic ultrasound is when I was working in the National Health Service. And things like PRP aren't provided. Well, I've not come across it in the public sector. It's something I've looked into in the private sector, but I think it comes down to business decisions, really, and making it cost effective with private healthcare models here in the UK. So I think that's a barrier for offering PRP. And the evidence is a bit shabby, I think.
I fully agree. Yes. I was about to say this. I mean, there's some RCTs, to my knowledge, showing no effect of PRP, specifically at the Achilles tendon. It's different. I mean, you have to differentiate, I think, between every tendon. But for the Achilles tendon, to my knowledge, there is no good data that PRP injection is really helping.
Yeah, that's my current understanding. So no, I haven't dabbled with PRP for any foot problems as of yet.
That's, again, interesting. That's a very cultural thing. I believe in the US, for example, they do it a lot. They put it everywhere and they are convinced it helps. But surgeon is convinced, it might help. I don't know.
Maybe it's not too much cultural, but also a little financial driven.
Yes. Yeah, I'm a bit suspicious of that as well.
So, but I think what becomes very clear in our discussion is that it's very important to differentiate the different pathologies underlying insertional tendinopathia. It's not the same, but there's different pathologies which respond differently to non-operative treatment and which can be addressed completely different surgically. So that's, I think, a very good point we found in our discussion, that it's very important to differentiate the different underlying pathologies.
And I think to a certain degree, having discussed on it now for more than 15 minutes, the option we have non-operatively are somewhat limited. And we try to have our hints, and we all have our, we study literature and we have our own thoughts on it. But it comes down to shockwave therapy, to maybe eccentric stretching exercises and glucocorticoid injections. And that's about all we got.
Yeah, absolutely.
But actually, from my feeling and from my understanding, a lot of these patients do quite well with these treatment options. And my feeling is that we only operate the tip of the iceberg, because the vast majority gets a lot better using non-operative treatment options.
Do you use any orthotic devices for a non-op?
I do, but I'm not as proactive with orthotics for insertional tendinopathy as I am for some other foot and ankle conditions. And that's partly down to the lack of evidence, which doesn't really suggest that hind foot alignment, whether the calcaneus is everted or inverted, that doesn't really seem to be influential. I think when I do prescribe an orthotic, it's usually a patient that has tried other conservative treatments first, and they are either not suitable for surgery or just don't want to have surgery, but they do want to try an alternative. And some people will come to me wanting an orthotic because they've read about it online. Because if you look online, if you type in Achilles tendinopathy, orthotics will come on as one of those common bullet point options. And patients pick up on that, and then they come and ask for one. So I'm just very careful to just set expectations correctly and say, we can try this, but it may not have that much of an influence on your symptoms. Sometimes it works tremendously well, but I wouldn't say it's consistent. I've seen some other feet where my gut says, yeah, an orthotic's going to work for this patient because their feet are really, really flat and the calcaneus is heavily everted. And if I change that, maybe that will have an effect. And that just hasn't been the case at all.
We do have a different feeling about gastroc tightness and its influence on insertional tendinopathia. But did you recommend patients to use any wedges to have a little heel rise, to get some tension off that insertion of the Achilles?
Yeah, I do. And I think that when an orthotic works, it works by the fact that you're giving a patient a heel raise. It's not necessarily that it's decreasing foot pronation. I think it's simply that you're giving a heel raise and you're taking that ankle into a slightly more plantar flex position, and that is helping with compressive stress around the tendon and the bursa. So I think an orthotic for this problem is, you know, in basic terms, it's just a very expensive heel raise. You could give them a £5 heel raise and it will probably work just as well. But that's very hard to convince a patient. I could tell a patient, you could have a simple heel raise or you can have this fancy custom-made orthotic. And a lot of the time, they want the orthotic.
This actually seems to be similar in Germany to the UK.
All right. So I think that's been very, very interesting to hear your perspectives and to hear from your experience. And yeah, it's been a great pleasure, Ben.
Same for me. A great first interview session for our podcast.
Absolutely.
I didn't expect it to work out that well.
I think this will be a common feature now.
Right. Well, I'm glad you guys have enjoyed it. It's been a pleasure, and I feel very privileged to be invited onto the podcast. I certainly will do my part in spreading the word of your podcast and posting it around, and hopefully it'll go from strength to strength.
Perfect. Ben, again, thank you very much, and hopefully we get the chance to talk to you again.